Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Water swallowing streets. Overnight, power lines sparking. Many who stayed behind, like Zach Zilkakis, now in the dark.
We're not sure what's out there. We're not sure what we're going to see when we open the door.
It's been more than 2 years since Hurricane Irma slammed into the Florida Keys and flooded the streets with debris and water. While some residents moved away from the island chain after Irma, the majority decided to stay. And for those that did, life in the Keys hasn't gotten much easier. Rebuilding efforts are still underway, and in some neighborhoods, street flooding has become an everyday occurrence, especially during this fall's unusually high tides. Now, the Monroe County government says that some of those roads might not be worth saving from rising sea levels. Last Wednesday, officials in the county released the results of a years-long look into how much and how high the island's roughly 300 miles of roads had to be elevated to keep them dry from sea level rise, and also how much it would cost. Christopher Flavelle is a reporter covering climate adaptation for the New York Times. And he told us that the costs to raise those roads are much higher than the government initially thought.
They estimated somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion to elevate all of the county's roads sufficiently high to protect it for a few decades. What they found was the actual cost is probably more like two or three times that. The problem with that difference is not only is it a lot of money in raw terms, but there are neighborhoods where there just isn't enough people, enough homes, enough property value to justify that expense.
You know, Christopher, the takeaway was down in Miami a couple summers ago where they are trying to raise some of the streets there and really grapple with potential future flooding. The Florida Keys feels much more vulnerable to the future that we're looking at when it comes to flooding and hurricanes, correct?
One way of looking at the threat brought by climate change to coastal areas is you've got different kinds of threats in terms of the pace of sea level rise and the exposure to hurricanes, but you also have different levels of value. And that term, that's a really loaded term. What constitutes a valuable neighborhood? Why is one place more valuable than another? But in naked economics terms, places like Miami constitute a huge amount of the state's GDP, lots of residents, lots of property taxes. Places like the Keys typically don't have that attribute. They're sparsely populated. They cost a lot of money to maintain. They don't have many residents to support that. And so the problem the Keys face is much more acute in that sense than Miami or other coastal cities because they just have to struggle to find the money to protect themselves and then to justify that kind of expense. And that's exactly where the Keys is right now.
What are the residents feeling about this?
It's a tough question. I went down expecting to find some degree of outrage, and I did. There were certainly residents saying, hey, I pay taxes. Why shouldn't my government do everything it possibly can to protect my home, and in that case, protect the road going to my home? But it was more subtle than that. There was also, I think, a pronounced element of, call it realism, people who said, I know that this part of the Keys will go underwater, just a question of how long it takes. And maybe it doesn't make sense to spend really incredible amounts of money just to elevate this one road. Maybe I could move.
Are the residents down in the Keys really willing to move?
We're not going to know until there's an actual plan on the table and somebody at the county or at the state draws a map and said, these places we can't protect. One thing I found in my reporting that I think it bears out everywhere you go is you see that places that have been hit multiple times by multiple floods or hurricanes or other disasters, the result tends to be a level of resignation. Whereas a part of the world that's been hit just once, they'll tend to say, I don't care what it takes, build this back.
So this raises a lot of questions about which places are worth saving or investing in. How do you expect that elected officials are going to make those calls?
If one were to describe not how this ought to work, but how it does work, I think it's probably fair to say at a high level, the places that get the most money are the ones that have either the best representation in Congress or know how to work the system, have sort of the local officials that are familiar with the way these grant dollars flow. So whatever ideal metric might be found for fairness, I don't think there's much argument that we're there right now. Everyone I talk to for my job says whether it's FEMA dollars or HUD dollars or almost any federal state program, they aren't really being allocated based on any notion of what makes sense. Just who has the greatest need, who makes the biggest fuss, and who gets hit the hardest. What places like the Keys are starting to ask is there a more fair way to do this? Because we know the costs will grow. And that's really what's driving all of this. You're not going to have endless willingness by federal taxpayers to keep on funding that level of reconstruction everywhere around the country as the tab grows because climate risk increases. So at some point, you'll get a Congress saying, even though Area X was just destroyed by a hurricane or a flood, we don't want to keep on funding this. And that's when it gets really hard. So in a sense, the Florida Keys is trying to get ahead of that and say, before the money runs out, what do we want to do for a plan? Is there a plan that maybe most residents can get behind? And that's what makes this experiment so important.
How far away are they from getting a plan? What's next for the residents of the Florida Keys?
When I was down there, officials said that they hope in 1 year to have a plan that covers the entire network of roads, showing how much they have to be elevated and at what cost. That will then, in theory, give them all the hard data they need. It won't give them the political answers. Presumably, at that point, they'll have to go to residents and say, okay, here's how we propose approaching this, given the data that we have. What do you, the voters, think? This could all end up terribly, right? You could certainly imagine a world where residents say, I don't care what your numbers say. If my road's underwater, you better raise it. It's a test of the numbers, but probably more importantly, it's a test of the ability of a community to say, can we accept a system deciding which places to save, even if that means the answer might not be my house?
Do we expect what unfolds in the Florida Keys to perhaps become a model for being a little bit more realistic and pragmatic about how these decisions are made?
Every coastal county will have to at least acknowledge what the Keys is doing and say, hey, if they're taking a methodological approach and they're being systematic and thoughtful. If we're not going to do that, why aren't we doing that? Why are we just throwing money at the places that have the most need in the moment? But my guess is officials will look at the Keys not just as sort of a system to look at, but also to see what the result is, right? I imagine they want to see, can you get community buy-in with this? And can you use the transparency they're going for to achieve some degree of realistic resignation, which is probably the best you can hope for. No one's going to be happy with these outcomes. But I think the big question is, can you get to a point where they seem fair in the eyes of people who are losing their neighborhoods, their homes, their culture because of these decisions? That is a really high bar, but I think that's the goal.
Christopher Flavelle is a reporter covering climate adaptation for the New York Times. Christopher, thanks as always for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
With the threat of climate change looming, more and more storms may be forcing local communities to respond. But here in New York, we've already seen the results of local efforts to mitigate the impact of storms brought about by climate change. Back in 2012, Hurricane Sandy struck the U.S. Northeast, leaving an estimated $70 billion worth of damages. More than 147 people died. And many of the mostly working-class communities on the New York City coastline were some of the most affected by the storm. In response, the New York City government created the Build It Back program. But its results were less than ideal, showing many around the country what not to do when attempting to mitigate the effects of storms. Joining us to discuss the Build It Back program is Amanda Farinacci, Staten Island reporter for Spectrum News, New York One. Amanda, I've followed your work for so long, and I'm really excited to have you with us here in studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Hurricane Sandy sweeps through New York in 2012, does a lot of damage, particularly in these coastal areas. New York City then decided to create something called the Build It Back program. What is Build It Back?
So Build It Back is a federally funded program. It began under the Bloomberg administration, and it was basically a plan that derived out of, let's say, the Mayor Bloomberg started with a rapid repair program, which was a basic program that was meant to use federal dollars to get people back in their homes. It assisted them with things like installing boilers and getting your heat and just sort of doing the necessary baseline repairs to get people back into their homes. After that, in early 2013, Bloomberg announced, we realized people want to stay in their homes. How can we do that? So it became a program that was basically designed to use the eligible funds that were being provided through the federal government to get people to stay back in their homes. You could either have your home rebuilt, elevated, repaired, so in some cases knocked down and then replaced.
We're seeing a lot of this happen across the country, right? Whether it's fires or hurricanes that are forcing people out of their homes, out of their communities. There's a big question, I think, for me, which is who should be able to stay in their communities, right? And how does the federal government and the state government and the city government access or allocate resources to making that happen? We talked a little bit about this, but the Build It Back program was meant to do repairs, and then it was really about keeping people in their homes. What cost are we talking about, Amanda?
The money came from the feds through community block development grants, CDBG money, and it was basically, those are just like resiliency funds, for lack of a better way to explain it. It was funded at first $1.7 billion. The program came up short, I think right around the sixth anniversary, announced a $500 million shortfall, so we're looking at $2.2 billion.
Billion dollars, taxpayer dollars.
Okay. Yes. And so I think it becomes really sort of a question of, you know, a financial picture, because you can make a strong case that, say, people need to live in their neighborhoods. They are entitled. Certainly in New York City, there's a shortage of affordable housing, right? And wanting to keep people where they can afford to live. But it really does beg the question of at what cost? Because that's a lot of money. The average home, the city will tell you at one point, to rebuild the home was about $640,000, an average. It was even more money to rebuild or to elevate and repair. These are astonishing numbers given, you know, the size of the homes, the quality they were in, the work performed. I think if you speak to some people who live in some of these constructed homes, they would tell you certainly that the repair work that they received is not worth $700,000.
And what we keep hearing from a lot of these areas, not just specific to New York, is that it's going to get worse, particularly on the coast, particularly where Hurricane Sandy hit a lot of these homes. So once this investment has been made by the city into rebuilding or elevating these homes, aren't those homes still at risk?
The city would say that the homes they've built are fortified beyond measure. And certainly one would hope that that's true, given, you know, the amount of money they spent on each one. I know on Staten Island and certainly out in the Rockaways and in sections of Queens, there is some work that's being done in tandem on Staten Island. They're in the process of making plans for a seawall to sort of help mitigate and slow down the waters. It seems like there should be two or, you know, a couple things happening at once. You create resilient, strong homes, but you need the barriers. You need the natural barriers. Out on the South Shore, there is an oyster bed that's being installed to slow down the speed of the waves. There's different things that are happening, certain talks of levees and things out in the Rockaways as well. I think it needs to be a big picture conversation. I'm not exactly sure that the housing piece is paramount. I think people in those neighborhoods would say it is absolutely the most important. But I do believe that there are certain neighborhoods where people just shouldn't live anymore.
Who's really benefiting from these programs?
These are people who, as I said, have been living in their neighborhoods for dozens of years, their families, because they are affordable. Certainly a home, the average median price of a home in many of the neighborhoods is only between $200,000 and $300,000. So these are people who oftentimes are older, have existing health conditions, have Medicaid, Medicare, pre-existing benefits that they get from the government. And, you know, they went into the Build It Back program because they didn't have the means to do it themselves, right? There was significant damage to a lot of zip codes in certain areas of the Rockaways, as well as the South Shore of Staten Island. That these are neighborhoods that have high economic incomes, people who are making money. Those people opted out of the program and did their own quote-unquote resiliency measures because they didn't want to be involved with the government programs and the bureaucracy and everything else. It was intended, I think, rightly to help those people who couldn't help themselves, but it just, the costs of it really beg the question of whether that's the right thing to do in the way they did it.
Where are we today, 7 years later?
So I think there were some 8,300 homes that were applicants through the program. I think all but 62 homes are still under construction. The de Blasio administration has really distanced itself from the program. They have gotten such criticism about the length of delay, the cost overruns, the unhappiness that people have about the bureaucracy and the quality of work. Mayor de Blasio likes, or the administration likes to say, oh, well, we inherited this problem from the Bloomberg administration, but it's worth pointing out that the Bloomberg administration only had the program for 6 months. We're now 7 years in. So, you know, the first time I reported on this story, we were talking about a home, the first home that was elevated on Staten Island. The value of the home is some $350,000. The price tag that the city spent was $786,000. The woman still to this day has issues in her home that she needs to continue to go back and say, can you help? Can you help? Can you help fix? So when we spoke to Amy Peterson, who's the head of the program, and said, like, Once you realize that you have one home that has gone so far off the rails, why not press pause and say, let's see if we can do this a better way? But I think the sense was a little bit of stubbornness that we're going to try to keep people in their communities. I think that was the right thing. But I think they needed to press pause a long time ago, because what happened then is that it just kept going and it just kept getting worse.
There are probably other programs that are going to be modeled around this, you know, in areas that are impacted. What do you see are the best practices for balancing that issue between people wanting to stay in their communities and the realities of climate change and the taxpayer dollars that are going to go into funding a lot of these programs? You know, at what point do you have to? I mean, that's a tough issue. That's what we're kind of trying to unpack here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing that the city did right is listen to people who said they wanted to stay, right? I'll give them that. I think they had very good intentions. I mean, short of that, I'm not really sure that there's anything. I don't think New York City should be the leader on this at all. I think that this is a missed opportunity. If there ever was a missed opportunity, this is perhaps the biggest one, because so often what happens in New York sets the stage nationally. I think in this case, people should look at New York and say, that's what we should not do. That's what we should not do.
Amanda Farinacci is the Staten Island reporter for Spectrum News, New York One. Amanda, thank you so much.
Thank you.